C'est l'heure de la chronique L'ONU vous concerne, animée par Robert Kaminker.
Nous sommes sur Radio Libre en Périgord et nous sommes au moment habituel de la semaine.
He was one of the first ever employees of the UN, and in 2018 he's still spreading the word via his weekly radio broadcast about how the UN works around the world in rural France. Robert Kaminker was just 18 in 1946 when he sat down to work in the UN typing pool on the day that the first historic General Assembly meeting took place in London. I'm Matt Wells, and welcome to The Lid Is On, our flagship podcast series here at UN News in the 1950s Secretariat Building at the heart of UN headquarters today, just off Manhattan's 42nd Street. He may have retired back in 1982, but Robert Kaminker paid us a visit just before the end of 2017 to relive some old times and see some old friends. Above all, he wanted to pass on a hopeful message from his first generation of UN staffers, most of whom had endured the horrors of World War II, to those of us in the building today.
In the first few years, most of the people that worked alongside of me were people who were absolutely convinced that the war that we had gone through should never occur again, and that the UN was the hope. And I must confess that I still think today that the UN is going, in the end, to be the thing that will save the world.
On the day Robert came in to visit, we took a look inside the chamber that for many is synonymous with the UN, where he'd spent many hours throughout a long career here in New York.
In that horseshoe that's in the middle there of the Security Council, there used to be tables. Tables and chairs and mics. And this is where the consecutive interpretation took place. There used to be four interpreters who took turns, and a little bit like today, the languages. Each interpreter knew at least two languages, sometimes three, like my father, and rendered it into his language. My father was doing into French.
A different atmosphere here now than in the 1970s?
It's completely different. Near that door over there, there used to be a booth with all the documents. And I sat in that booth quite a few times during Security Council meetings. And every time a draft resolution would come out, it would come to us, and we would go around the table inside the horseshoe to distribute to all the delegates.
Now, of course, it's all televised live on the internet, all the proceedings here.
I'm sure, and probably everyone has the documents on their computer. It's faster. It's much faster than it used to be. I mean, sometimes the council went into recess waiting for the different translations to be duplicated and sent out on paper. This happened.
Generally happy memories of being in this room?
Oh, yes.
I mean, it is quite a theatrical place, isn't it? The UN headquarters, grand theatres of the General Assembly in this room.
Yeah, but this is the one that's most televised. You see it much more often than the GA. And the GA is so vast that they concentrate most often on the speaker who's at the rostrum. It's the 15 members, and then there's, two seats at each end for invited countries that have to say something during the meeting. Thanks for bringing me here.
Now, take us back to the very beginning and what happened in terms of your family during World War II and how you first began to work for the UN. You are one of the first employees of the UN.
I don't know if you know about the Mohicans, but I'm one of the very, very last Mohicans.
The last of that original band
of the people who worked for the UN at the time that the UN moved from Hunter College to Lake Success in August 46.
But your career goes even back further than that,
yes,
doesn't it?
Yes. I started on the 10th of January 46, the first day of the first General Assembly.
Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, I have the honour today of welcoming to London this great assembly of delegates of the United Nations.
I started because my father, well-known interpreter and was already working with the preparatory commissions and so forth, He was asked whether he knew of a young person good in French spelling to be in the French typing pool as a reader. And he said, yes, I do know. I have a son who's doing nothing right now. He just finished his baccalaureate. He hasn't started university, but he can come in for the job. So I got a six-week contract. And in the end, because this was a position that cannot be filled easily outside of a French-speaking country, I got taken along by the UN and I stayed 36 years.
And you had invested an awful lot in the whole peacetime era because, of course, you and your family had lived through the Second World War and suffered huge losses in terms of your father's side. Many of your relatives died, tragically, in the concentration camps.
Quite a few of them. And we even found out later on when we were able to build a family tree, we found out that there were many more that we did not know, but that were relatives at some distance that had also been taken away in the camp. And fortunately, also, a number of them had managed to escape Europe before all the great troubles in between the wars, the Stalin regime and so forth on the Eastern Europe. And we managed to reunite with a number of them in Canada and the United States, in Argentina. There's a huge branch in Argentina. We're now all cousins and we meet from time to time.
So it's London, it's 1946. What are your memories of that first day at work for the UN?
The first day at work at the UN was not very difficult because I was in a completely French atmosphere and language was not a problem because my English in those days was better than most of my schoolmates because my family was always in the languages. But I perfected my English in London, those 3 months in London, by going to the cinema every evening and watching any film.
And that first job was extremely important, I understand, to you and your family.
In France in those days, that was January 46 then, there was very little to eat. There were restrictions in UK also, I know. And the fact that I had left France, I had left my mother and my sister, brothers and sister over there, left them an additional ration because I was eating off England, so to speak. Yeah. First of all, I was going to earn my first money. Second, I was, as I say, leaving the family behind in a slightly better position because I was not there. And I joined because there were work to do and so forth. It was not, at that point, idealism.
And what did it represent in terms of the move from London to the United States? It must have been an extraordinary transition period for those of you who'd been there from day one, as it were.
Well, it was very difficult because when it was decided to go, the main problem was the shortage of transportation. Airplanes were not a common thing yet, and the few ships that still crossed the Atlantic were still in troop transport configuration, not very comfortable. These were not cruise-like passages of the Atlantic. But the UN they looked for transportation all over the place and finally got 8 officers' cabins on an aircraft carrier, the HMS Chaser, which was an aircraft carrier that had been given over to the British under Lend-Lease, and the war being finished, it was being returned because it had actually not seen battle, I think, because it was not battle-scarred at all. And we had aboard, we had 56 airplanes and the various decks that were being transported back. But apparently the Americans didn't want them back, so they were dumped in the ocean while we crossed.
What did you do, America?
Why, they're after you, America.
You got excited and you started something.
Nations jumping all around.
I don't care. You got a lot to answer for.
And what were those first few years like in New York? How did you adapt and how did you adapt personally to it?
It was very simple for a young guy of my age. I was at that point 19, 20 years old. Everything was new, was fantastic, was much better than what I had before. So I adapted, in fact, quite easily and got very quickly into the language and into the idiosyncrasies of living in America because it's not the same as Europe, it's not the same as England. But I liked it and it was a wonderful experience.
As those first crises came, came along in terms of in international diplomacy and international crises. Were you optimistic about the organization?
Yes.
Did you all feel a sense of, you know, yes, growing enthusiasm, growing idealism, if you like, for
yeah,
what you were doing?
We were absolutely sure that that the UN was vastly superior to the League of Nations, mostly because the Americans were in, and that because there were agreements, because the Soviet Union and the United States were sitting around the same table, we thought that the things would settle, would take their natural turn in terms of being sensible about things, of solving things in a sensible way.
So did you feel that you were getting things done, that you
yes,
were succeeding?
Yes. I want to add also one thing, that in the Secretariat, whether it was in the Hunter College or in Lake Success or later on in the building here in New York, we did not follow the events, even the events inside the house, very closely, because each one has had his job in his cubicle somewhere on one of the floors. And if the New York Times had not existed, we would have known much less.
So in this kind of media-saturated age we're living in now, where every single move is kind of publicised around the world instantly, if you like.
Yes.
It was a very, very different environment. Completely
different. Everybody here in the UN has a computer on his desk and can log into any kind of news in any language and in any country whenever he wants to. We could not, because the telephone costs were so severe. We had very strict rules on you even using a telephone to tell your family that you were coming home late.
How important was it to have actually lived through that Second World War in terms of helping to make the work you were doing feel more visceral, more important, if you like, than, you know, compared to perhaps success generations that came afterwards who hadn't been through that life and death experience?
The much later generations were completely different. I mean, you felt sometimes like they were working because they liked the particular area that they were working in and they liked the salary at the end of the month. We did not think in those terms. The first few years, most of the people that worked alongside of me or that I met through the UN were people who were absolutely convinced that the war that we had gone through should never occur again, and that the UN was the hope. And I must confess that I still think today that the UN is going, in the end, to be the thing that will save the world.
Do you have any particular memory or recollection of a crisis in those early days that particularly affected you, that you think encapsulated really, you know, how complicated the whole business of maintaining peace and security?
In 1956, my job consisted mostly of being in the conference rooms and servicing the delegates in terms of documentation and so forth. So I sat in the Security Council and then later on in the General Assembly during both the Suez Canal crisis and then later on the Hungarian crisis.
Two very different but huge crises that did change world history.
Yes. The first one, the Suez Canal crisis, of course, affected me a bit personally because I'm patriotic. I'm French, and the French, and together with the British, had to cast a veto in the Security Council. And I've never liked the veto. The fact that the veto existed, although I understand that it must. The Hungarian veto came after that, the Hungarian thing, and each time...
That's from the Soviets, from the Russians.
Yes, but each of these two times, since the Security Council was prevented from doing its job by the veto, it went to a special session of the General Assembly each time, which, of course, got some wonderful resolutions adopted, but they do not carry the same weight as the Security Council.
And I also believe that you went and served in the Congo in the 1960s, a crucial period in UN history, because, of course, that was where the person who many regard as the most sort of charismatic and of all of the secretaries general, Dag Hammarskjöld,
yes,
died in a plane
yes,
crash.
Yes, he died in a plane crash. But the Congo situation developed when there were some rebels and the British, the Belgians, who were the colonial rulers, decided to give independence, just like that. And they simply left. And they left the country in chaos. I think there were 18 college graduates, as they say in the States, university graduates in the Congo when the Belgians left. 18, that's all. So the UN came in, and the UN force that ran, in fact, the country, more than 3,000 people. 3,000 people from UNESCO, from WHO, from UNICEF, from all kinds of things. And I was there in the operating center for general services to make sure that these 3,000 people could work. I mean, you could get pencils and could get some shaving blades in the commissary. it was that, that complicated.
Did you feel that that whole period was a bit of a turning point for the UN? And
well, I think it was the first big blue helmet thing with many contingents, with the accompanying problems of supplying, for instance, the food, because the rule in those days, I don't know if it's still the rule, but in those days was that the troops that were lent to the UN to be blue helmets had to have the same amenities at home, and the same food and so forth. And I remember in one of my jobs, I was also doing procurement, and there was an Indonesian contingent, and I had to find 16 different spices to go with their meals, because of Indonesian meals, which I happen to know from another, are extremely full of spices and so forth. And these were the things that we were daily doing.
These are the kind of small details, I suppose, that don't make the headlines in the world newspapers.
Of course not.
I mean, how important to the UN are these jobs that, in a sense, go unseen, like yours, over many decades?
In many instances, things would not happen if the little details were not attended to. It's just that simple. I mean, they would happen. I remember in the Congo, because I did two missions in the Congo. I did one mission as an administrative officer for a commission, and then I came back for 18 months for the full period. And I remember during that period, the carpool that we needed for these 3,000 people, including doctors and so forth, the carpool was in terrible state. It had been composed on the spot as the UN came in by taking a car here and there, an abandoned Belgian-owned car and this and that. So it was time to build a real decent carpool, because we knew that we would be there for a number of years. And I negotiated the first massive purchase of automobiles, and we had to decide between a little Renault and a little Citroën, which were available in nearby former French Congo. And we finally decided on the Citroën, because the Renault had its gearbox in the front, and there were too many accidents demolishing gearboxes. For that, the Citroën was a little bit safer. I signed an order for 200 Citroëns.
Do you feel that the UN, over the decades that you worked for it, and obviously you're still advocating strongly for it now in retirement, do you feel that the UN has evolved well?
Well, it has evolved in one sense well, because it is now involved in everything in the world. It started with small things, with one or two domains and more domains and so on. Now it's everywhere. This is what I keep saying on my little radio show. I keep saying that whatever activity is human is also part of the UN scheme somewhere. So that is a good involvement in my mind, because it has helped millions and millions and millions of people in small things, in small countries, in the back jungle and so forth. Where it has not evolved well is, I think, in two ways. First of all, the various secretariats of the various organizations, including, of course, the UN, the number of people needed to do a job has grown a bit too much. The other thing is that the nations, in all their resolutions, in all their organs of the UN, have created a number of organizations, of setups, which are no longer needed or could be absorbed. In spite of all this, I think the world is going to realize, and it has begun to realize, that the major issues are not what happens to something between India and
disputes over territory
in Pakistan on the Kashmir, but the main thing is the climate,
the earth warming, the food situation, relations.
Sustainable living, sustainable development.
That's right. Those are the two things that are important. And I think it is coming little by little to the realization of people. One example of this is the success, which many people think is relative, but I think it's real, of the Paris Conference on climate.
Finally, if you had to just think of one particular memory that to you encapsulates the good and the bad of decades of service for the United Nations, is there one that stands out?
One thing, that this is a long time ago, and we're back to Dag Hammarskjöld in the UN building. When he was re-elected to the second term, he came down to each office, shook the hand of every person in the building, and had a nice word for all of us. And to me, my colleagues were jealous because he talked a little longer to me because he had used my father as a personal interpreter.
So coming back to New York headquarters here towards the end of 2017, what's your verdict? What are your thoughts on the health of the UN and the UN Secretariat today?
The Secretariat is completely different. These are now not people inspired like we were by the very desired return to peace. I think people are good civil servants. Many of them do a very good job. There's no question about it. The safety of the job is no longer there since permanent contracts have been stopped.
In some cases, yeah.
In a number of cases. I think also the new building arrangements and so forth, I don't know if they please everybody. I would have had great problems, I think, as an administrative officer, at having open space to discuss with people.
But so you think it's a little overcrowded?
It's overcrowded and not private enough.
Is the UN overall, though, still fit for purpose, do you feel?
Oh, yes, I do.
Do you feel that radio is still as essential a communication tool as it always was
in
this era of social media?
In terms of smaller groups. I mean, you can go on TV and look at CNN and you have an idea and so forth, but it is not the same thing as having a little local radio station, which on the one hand announces the next meeting of society so-and-so, or the hours in the public library have changed. It's that type of radio that I'm in, and I love it.
Thanks very much for your service, and it's been a great pleasure meeting you. Thanks for coming in to our studio here at headquarters.
Well, it's just a short trip that I took to the States, and I'm happy to have made contact.
Thanks for coming in and talking to the Leaders On.
Thank you.
That was the extraordinary Robert Kaminka, still a believer in the value and power of the UN system to change the world for the better via his own radio show in southwestern France. You've been listening to the Lid Is On podcast from UN News with me, Matt Wells. I'll leave the final word to Robert as he closes out a recent edition of his programme.
Je vous remercie de votre écoute. Je termine ici la chronique L'ONU vous concerne et je vous retrouve la semaine prochaine. Merci et à bientôt.
C'était la chronique L'ONU vous concerne sur RLP.